Today is June the 27th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are slightly different. This was covered a few weeks ago, but it is worth repeating. There is a website, www.haveibeenpwned.com. You enter your email address and it will determine what dark web group may have your email address. You can also enter your password. The entry itself is encrypted and it will check to see if the password is in the library stored in the dark web. If it exists in the dark web, change the password and make sure it is unique. The dark web has this massive library of passwords that is used for brute force hacking. The Supreme Court last Thursday ruled that internet retailers can be required to collect sales taxes even in states where they have no physical presence. The decision in South Dakota versus Wayfair was a victory for brick-and-mortar businesses that have long complained that they are put at a disadvantage by having to charge sales taxes while many online competitors do not, and states that have said that they are missing out on tens of billions of dollars in annual revenue. This is going to allow state and local governments to improve their tax enforcement and put local businesses on a more level playing field. In Thursday's ruling, the court effectively overturned a system that it created in 1992 in which the court ruled that the Quill Corporation versus North Dakota, that the Constitution bars states from requiring businesses to collect sales taxes unless they have substantial connection to the state. The Quill decision helped pave the way for the growth of online retailing by letting companies sell nationwide without navigating the complex patchwork of state and local tax codes. 45 states and the District of Columbia collect statewide sales taxes. Local sales taxes are collected in 38 states. Oregon, Montana, New Hampshire, Delaware, and the state of Alaska has no state sales tax, but Alaska has local sales taxes. The five states with the highest average combined state and local sales tax are not what you think they are. They are Louisiana, 9.98%, Tennessee, 9.46%, Arkansas, 9.30%, Alabama, 9.01%, and Washington, 8.92%, and these five states have the highest average combined state and local sales tax. The border county of Salem County, which is in New Jersey, is exempt from collecting the 6.875% statewide sales tax and instead collects half of that, 3.4375. It is a policy designed to help local retailers compete with the neighboring state Delaware, which foregoes a sales tax. So as you can see, it's pretty much very convoluted. Writing for the majority in the 5-4 ruling, Justice Anthony Kennedy said that the Quill decision caused states to lose annual tax revenues of up to $33 billion. Quill puts both local businesses and many interstate businesses with physical presence at a competitive disadvantage relative to remote sellers. Remote sellers can avoid the regulatory burdens of tax collection and can offer de facto lower prices caused by the widespread failure of consumers to pay the tax on their own. Justice Clarence Thomas, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Samuel A. Alito, and Neil Gorsuch joined the majority opinion. In the dissent, Chief Justice John Roberts agreed that the court's ruling in this area had been wrongly decided, but said there were insufficient reasons to overrule the precedents. Any alteration to those rules with the potential disrupt the development of such a critical segment of the economy should be undertaken by Congress. And he was joined by Justice Stephen G. Breyer, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, and Justice Elena Kagan in the dissent. South Dakota enacted a law that required all merchants to collect a 4.5% sales tax if they had more than $100,000 in annual sales or more than 200 transactions in the state. State officials sued these three large retailers, Wayfair, Overstock, and Newegg, for violating the law. South Dakota's appeal had bipartisan support, including from attorney generals in 35 states and the District of Columbia. South Dakota would be able to now start collecting tax on online purchases. Other states may be close behind, and in anticipating Thursday's ruling, several states, including North Dakota, have passed laws modeled on South Dakota's wording. Other states will have to change their laws if they want to take advantage of the decision. Justice Kennedy's decision left open the possibility that some transactions were so small and scattered that no taxes should be collected. However, he did not specify how small is small and how scattered is scattered. It's a big gray area. The court also did not decide whether states may seek sale taxes retroactively, which South Dakota law does not. Thursday's ruling should benefit local businesses, at least where local sales taxes are collected at the state level, but it won't help municipal governments in states such as Pennsylvania and New Mexico, where the tax codes prevent local jurisdiction from taxing remote sellers. For consumers, the reversal of Quill could mean paying more for products bought online. In theory, most states already require consumers to pay a use tax, equivalent to the state sales tax when buying online, but in practice, few consumers do so. Owners of brick-and-mortar stores welcome the ruling. Overstock said the decision would have little impact on its business, but argued that with more than 12,000 different state and local taxing districts, the ruling would present a huge compliance challenge for internet startups. And Chief Justice Roberts had a similar argument in his dissent. Wayfair, in a statement, said it already collected sales tax on approximately 80% of its orders in the United States. As a result, we do not expect today's decision to have any noticeable impact on our business. That's what the company said. Well, the impact on Amazon could be, well, it's varied. The company collected taxes on 45 states that have one, but about half of Amazon's total online sales come from independent merchants who simply post their inventory on the online store. In most states, those merchants are responsible for calculating and paying the various state taxes if they are owed. In the past year, Washington State and Pennsylvania have enacted laws requiring internet retailers to collect taxes on third-party sales. In other words, they've enacted a law saying Amazon has to collect the taxes even though it's not out of their inventory. More states are expected to follow suit. For this service, Amazon will charge sellers a fee of approximately 2.9% of the collected sales tax. In effect, the cost to the online retailer is an additional 2.9% of the collected tax. This would be passed on to the online purchaser if the seller has $100,000 in annual sales or more than 200 transactions in the state. How would you know if you will have that much business that may exceed that much in dollars and the number of purchases at the beginning of the year? While most businesses dread being audited, it often comes as a surprise to learn that state tax authorities routinely send auditors to or hire auditors from other states to capture unreported sales and use tax revenues. Some states go so far as to have remote offices. Now, how would state tax authorities know who are online sellers out of the state? Well, you know how they find out? The seller is responsible for getting a sales tax ID number from each state where tax is to be collected, and that is what Amazon is requiring. Well, how do I feel about it? Objectively, it was the correct decision by the Supreme Court that internet sales tax is required. However, subjectively, as a consumer, I really don't want to pay any more than I have to, but that is the subjective part. Why did I say objectively I agree with it? There are many items that I want to see what it looks like. I want to get a sense of what the build is, the nuances to a product. And I could name you one thing that what I find very frustrating are shoes. You have the same size, but with different manufacturers, they don't all fit the same way. Yes, some people will say you can return the product and take another size. You keep returning it over and over again. And as what's been happening with Amazon, they have been banning certain users now or certain buyers now from returning because they've been returning too many items. Having the product in front of you where you can examine in great detail, it's worth something. So when I do that and I find it's worth it, I don't mind paying the extra, and I've done it. I pay the extra money for a product that I could have gotten cheaper on mail order, but I feel that to support the retailer that I'm using, I really should be patronizing him, and I do. By the way, Joe, what say you about this?
Hank, the other day when you asked me what I thought of the recent Supreme Court decision on mail order and internet sales and sales taxes, I gave you an instant answer. My reaction was complete. I was against it. I thought it was foolish. I thought it was impossible. I thought it was unfair. Sales taxes from an internet sale? What benefit does the internet company get for its paying the sales tax? None. It doesn't have to worry about police coverage or fire coverage or garbage collection. The locality doesn't offer the internet company any benefit. How do they have a right to collect sales taxes? And then I read the decision, and then I did some background research, and then I changed my mind. Can you believe it, Hank? I changed my mind based on the interpretation of the law by the Supreme Court, based upon everything I read. Before I had gotten the information, I had made an opinion, and in my opinion, that opinion was wrong. I can't believe it. I was wrong. Me. I'm never wrong. You know that. I've told you that 100 times. Well, let's look at it. Why should Amazon or Wayfair or Quill, the company the decision was originally based on, why should they pay a sales tax if they don't have a significant nexus in the locality? What do they mean by nexus? A brick-and-mortar building is definitely a nexus. But is it a nexus if you're simply shipping into an area, into a locale? Well, the states and localities got around that problem by saying it's not just a sales tax if the company is not in their region to say a sales tax. Well, the customer is in that region, and the customer is required to pay a use tax, which coincidentally is exactly the same amount as a sales tax. Well, that complicates matters a little bit. But you have to also look at the fact that today is a lot different than when the Commerce Clause was written into the Constitution. We don't need a brick-and-mortar location in order to buy anything. I do a great deal of shopping on Amazon. Incidentally, I also pay a great amount of sales taxes because Amazon says that any of their products that they have in their warehouse that they sell, they collect sales tax on, and they remit the sales tax to the locality that deserves it. Well, this is all more complicated than we can think. So Amazon submits a sales tax. Amazon's a good-sized company. As a matter of fact, it's the largest retailer in the United States, perhaps in the world. Yes, I know, Hank. It passed Walmart some time ago. The thing is that it's not that simple. It's not just a question of collecting 8.25% on every sale and sending it to Albany. It's a different amount for every county, every locale, every state. Now, Walmart didn't do that. Walmart had a very simple thing. In each store, they had a cash register, and the cash register determined what that locality required, and it rang it up. But now we're asking every mail order, every internet company to have a record of over 10,000 localities and what they charge, but not just what they charge for different items. Food might be exempt, toilet paper might not be. Might be a special rate on drugs, and there might be a different rate on Coca-Cola. I don't know. I'm not a computer. But I can buy one. Well, is that fair to make me go and spend extra money just so I can collect sales taxes from East Podunk Junction, Wisconsin? Well, the government tries to cover that to some degree by saying, well, the computer and the software is a business expense and you can deduct it from your profits before you pay your taxes. Phooey. But you got to do it. There's no way around it. There's nothing in sales tax collection that's going to be fair to everybody. Different people on the Supreme Court felt differently about it, and so you had two opinions, one the majority opinion, one the minority opinion. And each of those opinions, you had some justices buying into the whole thing and some justices accepting only parts of it. Let's go just to the bottom line. You got a sales tax, you got to pay it. You got a use tax and you're not willing to pay it, then your company's going to deduct the sales tax, and that's basically what's happening. It's taxes aren't fair, but taxes are required. How else would we be able to pay the legislatures their ridiculously large salaries that they demand? Oh, I wasn't supposed to say that, was I, Hank?
The Supreme Court says warrant is necessary for phone location data. The U.S. Justices says that law enforcement needs a warrant to follow your digital footprint. The Supreme Court ruled that police needs warrant to gather phone location data as evidence for trials. In a 5-4 decision last Friday, the justices reversed and remanded a decision by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The case was Carter versus U.S. is the first case about phone location data that the Supreme Court has ruled on. That makes it a landmark decision regarding how law enforcement agencies can use technology as they build cases. Disputes dates back to a 2011 robbery in Detroit, after which police gathered months of phone location data from Timothy Carter's phone provider. They pulled together 12,898 different locations from Carter over 127 days. The legal and privacy concern was that police gathered the 4 months' worth of Carpenter's digital footprint without a warrant. A Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals judge ruled that cell phone location data isn't protected by the Fourth Amendment, which forbids unreasonable search and seizure and therefore didn't require a warrant. In the Supreme Court's ruling, Chief Justice John Roberts Jr. wrote the government's searches of Carpenter's phone records were considered a Fourth Amendment search. The government's position fails to contend with the seismic shifts in digital technology that made possible the tracking of not only Carpenter's location, but also everyone else's, not for a short period, for years and years and years, he wrote. Roberts said allowing government access to historical GPS data infringes on Carpenter's Fourth Amendment protections and expectation of privacy by providing law enforcement with an awe-encompassing record of his whereabouts. Roberts added that historical GPS data presents an even greater privacy risk than real-time GPS monitoring. Carpenter's attorneys, including lawyers from the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, argued before the Supreme Court that cell phone location data constitutes sensitive digital records and should be protected under the Fourth Amendment. This is a groundbreaking victory for Americans' privacy rights in the digital age. The Supreme Court has given privacy laws an update that it has badly needed for many years, finally bringing it in line with the realities of modern technology and life. The government can no longer claim that the mere act of using technology eliminates the Fourth Amendment protections. Phone location data is a hot-button issue for privacy advocates. In May, Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, asked phone services providers why they were giving away location data to Securus Technologies, a service that monitors calls to prison inmates, which police could use to track anybody's phone in the United States without a warrant. Also in May, the Federal Communications Commission opened an investigation into LocationSmart, a company that offered phone tracking capabilities. The Supreme Court's decision now sets a precedent for every American's phone location data being used in criminal investigation. It's just not about Carpenter, it's about the rights of Americans who own cell phones, which is in excess of 95% of the people in the country, said the senator from Oregon. Wyden said that Friday's ruling was a welcome step for privacy and fighting against the expanding power of government surveillance. The court's recognition that digital devices can generate near-perfect surveillance of a person's private life is a validation of the vital protections against unreasonable search and seizure provided by our Constitution. The losing argument was that the phone companies can provide customers' data to law enforcement because they own those records, not the person. During the trial, U.S. Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dreeben told the Supreme Court that people agreed to hand over the information to providers for their service. It is asking a business to provide information about the business' own transactions with a customer. This is what Dreeben said in November. Before the trial took place, major tech companies, including Apple, Facebook, and Google, filed a friend of the court brief with the Supreme Court, urging the justices to make it harder for law enforcement officials to obtain individuals' data without a warrant. While the decisions set a ruling for historical GPS data, the Supreme Court said it does not apply to security cameras, business records, or real-time location tracking. As technology improves, so will surveillance techniques. Cell tower location data is going to become much more accurate once 5G rolls out. Friday's decision shows that the Supreme Court is willing to continue to weigh privacy implications that technology continues to change. For people who are understandably worried about technological evolution enabling tools and mass surveillance, they can take solace in the fact that the court has willingness to limit the government's abilities to surveil. Apple has determined that a small percentage of the keyboards in certain MacBook and MacBook Pros and MacBook Pro models may exhibit one or more of the following behaviors. Letters or characters repeat unexpectedly. Letters or characters do not appear. Keys feel sticky or do not respond in a consistent manner. Well, these are complaints that have been reported in the press and Apple has looked at it. And they now say that Apple or an Apple authorized service provider will service eligible MacBook and MacBook Pro keyboards free of charge. The type of service will be determined after the keyboard is examined, and it may involve in the replacement of one or more keys or the whole keyboard. The eligible models, here's how you can identify, I hope you have the patience to hear this, to identify your computer model and to see if it is eligible for this program, it's listed as follows. MacBook Retina 12-inch, early 2015, early 2016, and 2017. MacBook Pro 13-inch, 2016, 2017, two Thunderbolt 3 ports, MacBook Pro 13-inch, 2016 and 2017, four Thunderbolt 3 ports, and MacBook Pro 15-inch, 2016 and MacBook Pro 15-inch, 2017. No other Mac notebook models are part of this program. Your MacBook or MacBook Pro will be examined prior to any service to verify that it is eligible for this program. The type of service will be determined after the keyboard is examined, and it may involve the replacement of one or more keys or the whole keyboard. The service turnaround time may vary depending upon the type of service and availability of replacement parts. If the MacBook Pro is the only system you have, you have to take into account that you may not have use of the system for possibly days. And what they're asking you to do is, before you send anything for service, back up your data. They also have another caveat. If your MacBook or MacBook Pro has any damage which impairs a service, that issue will need to be repaired first. In some cases, there may be costs associated with the repair. Dr. Alfred Poor today with Wearable and Health Technologies will be talking about smartphone diagnosis sleep apnea. He'll also be talking about wireless monitors reduce bed sores and augmented reality glasses make the workplace safer. From the Tech Corner, I'm going to be talking about cord cutting with Tubi TV. And finally, Marty Winston on home automation will be covering monitoring power presence at outlets.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Do you snore? Well, it's possible you may have obstructive sleep apnea. And this is a condition where while you're sleeping, your breathing stops or pauses, sometimes frequently, many times within the space of an hour. And it's, you know, a lot of people just don't think it's that big a deal. It's annoying. It can be inconvenient for any partner you might have who's sleeping in the same room with you or trying to sleep. But a lot of people think, well, you know, snoring's not such a big deal. As it turns out, it could be a very big deal. Research from the Wisconsin Sleep Cohort Study, which is a longitudinal study that's been going on for over 18 years, they discovered that for subjects who have breathing interruptions 30 times or more within an hour while they're sleeping, they are 5 times more likely to die in that 18-year period of the study than those whose breath was interrupted 5 times or less per hour. Dying's kind of final, so maybe this is a big deal. One of the issues is that a lot of people don't get their snoring diagnosed to see whether or not they have a sleep apnea problem in the first place. By some estimates, up to 85% of all sleep apnea cases are never diagnosed. Why is that? Well, if you're going to get tested for sleep apnea, you've got to go to a sleep center. You can't be tested in your doctor's office on a regular office visit. You've got to go to a sleep center, get hooked up, be monitored while you try to sleep in a strange bed in a strange place with somebody watching. And a lot of people find that intrusive and inconvenient and something they just would rather not do. And after all, it's only snoring. Another part of the problem is that some people just aren't aware of the seriousness of this problem and what the implications can be for your health. The third part of the problem, though, is that sleep apnea is often associated with obesity. And we all know how difficult it is to deal with overweight issues and how difficult people find it to lose weight. And so this is a whole series of problems that lead to why people don't get diagnosed. And again, after all, it's just snoring, right? Well, there is a solution that may be on the way for this. There's a company in Australia that we've talked about before. It's called ResApp, and they have created a smartphone app that is able to diagnose a child's cough simply by listening to a sound sample recorded on a smartphone. They've also done tests where they've been able to diagnose a range of different chronic breathing problems in adults simply from a sound sample. Well, they're at it again with apnea. By having the smartphone app listen to you while you sleep, it's able to diagnose whether or not you have sleep apnea and how severe the problem might be. And in fact, in a test comparing it to the gold standard kinds of instrumentation and monitoring that they use in sleep centers, they discovered that it was 86% sensitivity and 83% specificity when it comes to comparing it with the gold standard. So it's a highly accurate technique, even in this initial trial that only involved a bit over 700 people. But it shows a way that could be very convenient and easy and quick and can be done in the privacy of your own home and develop data that could then be shared with your healthcare professionals who could decide whether or not you have a condition that needs to be treated and help you deal with this and avoid some of the complications that can result from sleep apnea. Most people would agree that healthcare costs are rising much too fast and becoming a great burden on our nation's economy, both for us individually and as a community as a whole. And one of the places where healthcare costs are high are in hospitals, as you might expect. More than 2.5 million people in the United States develop pressure ulcers each year. These are commonly known as bed sores, and they occur when a patient is left in the same position for extended periods of time. The pressure stops the blood flow, and the tissues get damaged, and the sores appear, and these can turn into wounds that are very difficult to treat and cure. This can happen with people in wheelchairs. It can also happen with people who are sedentary for long periods of time, but a big area where it's a problem is in hospitals where patients are confined to beds and often, because of their condition, don't move about on their own naturally and just lie there in one position. These result in what are called hospital-acquired pressure injuries. And these injuries increase patient fatality rates, decreases the quality of life for the patients, results in longer hospital stays because the bed sores have to be treated and cured. And this all totals up to anywhere from $9 to almost $12 billion extra annually that we spend that could be avoided. Well, there's a company called Leith Healthcare, and they've done two large-scale studies that show the effectiveness of the sensors that they can put on patients. These are waterproof, wearable devices, and basically they detect the patient's motion, and they can run for up to 3 weeks on a single battery charge. So they don't need a lot of attention or management. And then wirelessly, they transmit data about the patient's movements. A system analyzes that data and can alert hospital staff when a patient hasn't been moved in a sufficient period of time, and so that they can then go and reposition the patient and help prevent the occurrence of these pressure injuries. Well, they found that in one hospital in California, there was a 50% improvement in patient repositioning using this Leith system. And in a second study at the Stanford School of Medicine, they found an 85% reduction in these pressure injuries using this wireless sensor system in an intensive care unit. So 85% reduction of that cost, if we could reduce that $10 to $12 billion by 85%, that would be a significant drop in the bucket when it comes to trying to control healthcare costs. So this is just another example of how wearable technologies can help us get better outcomes and reduce healthcare costs at the same time. We've talked a lot about augmented reality and some of the different applications for it. A lot of the places that it's being used already is in industry and commercial operations, especially in manufacturing, because augmented reality glasses like Google Glass and other similar products can help display information that's useful to the individual worker right while they're working and don't have to take their hands off from what they're trying to accomplish. They can just look at the screen that's suspended in front of them and get the information they need. Well, there's an interesting development. There's a company called Dacry. They have developed a series of smart glasses that do more than just respond to requests for information by the wearer. It can actually warn the wearer of environmental conditions and health hazards and safety hazards that they might encounter. So it could warn them when they're nearing a piece of machinery that could pose a hazard to them as for possible injury. It could warn them about a slippery floor. It can tell them if an object is too hot to touch. So this is a lot more than just throwing up blueprints and providing assembly instructions. At the same time, the system also monitors some of the biometric data about the individual worker. It can show when the worker is tired or stressed or distracted. The system also includes two-way communications so that people who are monitoring the worker in the field are able to communicate with that person and check on them, make sure they're okay, and maybe advise them to change what they're doing or maybe take a break or whatever. So the sensors, the wireless connectivity, the two-way flow of information, and the ability to warn workers about potential hazards should be able to help reduce injuries, reduce downtime, save money. You know, this is another example of where augmented reality glasses can have a major impact on the day-to-day operations in business.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Tubi TV was launched in 2014 with over 20,000 TV shows and movies. In November 2015, they struck a deal with MGM Studios and Lionsgate, growing their library to over 50,000 titles. In April of 2015, they made their first major partner deal with Paramount Pictures to add 50 films per month on Tubi TV. Well, what devices does Tubi TV support? They support Roku, Apple TV, Chromecast, Xbox 360, Xbox One, Sony, PlayStation 4, Samsung, Amazon Fire TV, and they have a website that you can watch on a regular PC, TubiTV.com. Tubi TV, the free internet TV network, is working on your behalf, they say, to unlock premium content so entertainment is free, without the burden of credit cards. They have the largest collection of premium and unique movies and TV shows for free, forever, since advertisers pay so you never have to. If you're looking for great original content or a large selection of both classic and current TV shows and movies, you could turn to Tubi TV. That's T-U-B-I TV. I heard about it just the other day. It's available in both iOS App Store and Google Play Store, and it's available for Windows operating system and other platforms. Tubi TV has been around for several years now, and back in 2015, it had added 50 films from Paramount, including fan classics like Basic Instinct and Hunt for Red October. But as it turns out, not many other people are aware of Tubi TV, and that's a shame. What's the catch, you ask? Well, Tubi TV is actually free. It does feature frequent commercials from various ad partners. Although you won't be able to watch the latest summer blockbuster through the app a couple weeks after it leaves theaters, you'll be able to find other classics and fun television shows to keep you entertained. In fact, there are plenty of titles now in the Tubi TV catalog that aren't available on other services. So even if you are already a subscriber to something else, you could always complement it with the Tubi TV app. After all, you won't be paying for it. Monitoring power at each and every outlet, something that few people would ever think about, but Marty explains how it can be an important safety concern and describes his own simple solution for building a homebrew gizmo to report power presence using five simple components, and how that monitoring helps to speed identifying wiring problems in the cybernetic house. Gee, I use a simple voltmeter and test if there's any voltage. I gotta learn something new, and what's this thing he calls gizmo?
I made a recent decision, and with it a commitment, to add to the sensors of our cybernetic house by getting information from about 100 outlets to tell me whether each one of them is connected to an active source of AC power. So this segment is first about why I think that's important, and second, giving you a look over my shoulders idea with the rough math of putting together a really simple circuit. Just five parts to do it. I'll be naming those parts twice, once in the middle and once at the end. But to keep things easy, let's assume that you're in a place with 15 circuit breakers and 75 outlets, five each. And instead of talking to my control system, you use my little gizmo to light up a panel, either turning it on or turning it off, depending on how you want to set up the logic, if there's power at the outlet. When all 75 outlets have power, all of the lights are the same and all is well. But suppose one or two or a few of them all suddenly tell you, whoops, nothing here. What does that mean? Well, if they're all saying no power, it might mean your power just failed, or it might mean the master breaker just tripped, or that somebody threw the master switch. But if only a few lose power, what could that mean? If all of any one breaker's outlets lose power, easily the breaker tripped. If you took notes or labeled your lights, you might even know which one. But what if some of the outlets connected to a breaker stay powered and some don't? That might be as easy as a ground fault event, and you will definitely want to investigate that quickly. They're not all false positives. Remember, they're there to save people from electrical dangers. Be sure the ground fault interrupters were fast enough at getting that job done. The most serious outcome is that some of the outlets on the same breaker line are on and some off because something happened to the wiring between them. Maybe a connection break, or a suicidal squirrel, or something else. Whatever it is, you don't want to lose any time checking up on it, beyond inconvenience. Some disconnects can create enough heat to start a fire. If you know where the wiring runs between the last outlet with power and the first outlet without power, manually trip that breaker and use a remote read infrared thermometer to look for hotspots, either along the wires if you can see them, or along the walls if you can't. You may have already thought of this from what I just said. There's something you can do with just pencil and paper to help you troubleshoot electrical problems. Make yourself a rough map. Rough sketch the floor plan, label the outlets, even something like south bedroom, west wall, left can work. Go to the breaker box, make a list of all the breakers by number and any tags or notes that are next to them. Then, as much as you can, for each outlet on your list of outlets, write down the number of the breaker that controls it. Clip that near your breaker box. It's an amazing shortcut if there's a problem. I can tell you, this is an especially good approach if you can do it before the wiring goes into the walls, because you can plan things logically and get it all into a spreadsheet, which in my case at least is a lot more legible than pencil and paper. In our cybernetic house, we want to go 40 years without encountering major maintenance, repairs, or replacement, so nipping things in the bud is a priority. That's a reason for all of our power presence monitoring. Now, how are you going to get all of those outlets to tell you they have power? One fairly easy way would be to connect a 120-volt coil electromechanical relay and use its contacts, which aren't connected to the 120 volts, to tell a GPIO or control system, hey, we got power, hey, we don't. But remember, we also want our house to be energy miserly, and a relay uses many, many times the power of the solution I'm about to explain. I'm using an opto-isolator, in this case the Vishay VOL628A. It comes in a little plastic dip package, just like a lot of familiar logic gates, though this one has just four pins. Inside, there are two LEDs connecting to two of those pins, in parallel but with opposite polarities, so one lights up on the positive cycle of the power line and the other on the negative cycle. The other two pins connect to an NPN phototransistor, its collector and its emitter, so there is no electrical connection between the first two with the LEDs and the second two with the phototransistor. That's the isolated part of an opto-isolator. When those LEDs light, they shine right into the phototransistor and switch it on, which creates a path from its positive output connection, its collector, to its ground connection, its emitter. Now, here's a warning. Don't duplicate what I'm doing. My circuit is not UL approved. If you don't know what you're doing around line power, it can be really dangerous. You need to know about more than just the schematic. You need to understand insulation beyond just the wires, mechanical stability, and more. So don't try this at home. I looked up the spec data sheet for the VOL628A opto-isolator to see how much or how little current would drive it to enough brightness to be effective. 1 milliamp would be plenty. When connecting to AC power, I prefer putting more components in the neutral wire path than in the hot wire path. So I connected a 100K current limiting resistor between the neutral connection and one of the opto-isolator LED connect pins, and connected the other LED connect pin to the hot connection on the power line. At least the power line at that outlet. I added one more part between those pins, a bidirectional transistor protective device to shunt surges or spikes. In this case, It's a BZW0494B. Again, it connects directly in parallel with the LED pins and not directly across the power line. Now, let's get to the phototransistor side. We know that every time the power cycles, that phototransistor is going to see one or the other of the two LEDs light up, and that's going to turn on the transistor. Between those blinks, the transistor is going to turn off. Well, those blinks are 8.5 milliseconds apart. And one thing we don't want to do is to have a control system think there's been a power failure every 8.5 milliseconds. We could probably use programming to get around that, but I'm not in love with the idea of introducing a new processing chore for every outlet every 8.5 milliseconds. Software, of course, isn't the only answer. How much hardware would it take? How about one well-chosen capacitor? We'll get there in a second. Our control system's switch inputs are on a 3.3-volt logic circuit that adds lots of GPIO pins, each with a 100K ohm pull-up resistor. Theoretically, I could just connect the phototransistor's collector to the GPIO pin and its emitter to the control system ground, but that would lead to those 120 power on-off, on-off signals every second. So this next bit will take some attention, please. That GPIO pin is strictly binary. If the voltage on it is less than 20% of its supply voltage, which in this case is 3.3 volts, 20% of that, if the voltage on it is less than 20% of 3.3, it reads that as a logic low or zero. If the voltage on it is 80% or more of the supply voltage, it reads that as a high or one state. In between is unpredictable land. There is no single specific voltage in the middle that will always be interpreted as a high or a low, a one or a zero. We have to keep our voltage out of there. The 100K ohm pull-up resistor at the GPIO pin is a help. If there's nothing connected to the pin, it keeps the pin at an unmistakable high logic level, shorted to ground, and it's an unmistakable low. So how do we do that just for changes and not have it happen 120 times per second? Consider what happens when we put a capacitor from the GPIO pin to ground. Every 8.5 milliseconds, when the phototransistor turns on, it shorts the capacitor to ground, putting it at 0 volts. When the LED blinks off and the transistor switches off, the capacitor starts charging through the 100K pull-up resistor. With the right capacitor value, we can keep the voltage in that assured logic low range during the LED's dark time. It lets us take advantage of something called the RC time constant, RC for resistor and capacitor. And formally, you might consider this design to be a low-pass filter. Yes, it does introduce a short delay in reporting an outage to the controller, a delay of about 0.1 seconds, which I'm delighted to say means that it will be able to ignore a large number of electrical utility power interruptions that last for less than that. We're using a 1 microfarad tantalum capacitor. 1.1 might be a little better, but in our case, we add a 0.1 microfarad capacitor at the input of the controller board on every pin, sometimes a little bigger if it's a special purpose pin, which puts that in parallel with this one and gives us our total of 1.1 microfarads. We do one more thing with that 1 microfarad capacitor. We don't connect it directly to the wire going from the collector to the GPIO pin. We connect it there through a 100 ohm resistor. That's simply there to very slightly throttle back the amount of current that the capacitor discharges into the junction of the phototransistor, a little protective measure. I'll list the parts again in a moment, but again, I strongly advise you not to duplicate what I'm doing here, because connecting things directly to the power feed in an outlet box is potentially dangerous enough to be the last thing you ever do. If you just want to see how it all works, try it with a 9-volt battery instead of the power line, and use a meter or an oscilloscope to watch the output. I explained why I think it's worth the trouble of monitoring power outlets. I'll be squandering a tiny fraction of a watt in total across the entire house to do this everywhere. Beyond the outlets, by the way, I can use the same approach to also hack into any of the bathroom exhaust fans, the ones that automatically turn on when they sense the rising humidity in a shower or somebody coming into the throne room. Now, those parts. The Vishay VOL-628A optoisolator. The Transzorb BZW0494B bidirectional transient voltage suppressor. A 100K ohm quarter watt resistor. A 100 ohm 1/10 watt resistor. a 1 or 1.1 microfarad 16-volt tantalum capacitor. Now, here's an interesting footnote. When you spec a tantalum capacitor for 4 times the voltage it will ever see, its life expectancy skyrockets. Our circuit is at less than 4 volts, so a 16-volt part does that. But honestly, is this functionality really all that important to you? I hope not. Sometimes I build stuff like this so you won't have to. I do have to, but you don't. The good thing is that at least now you can explain to your friends how it all works. And don't forget to remind them to back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Schedule computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on What's a Router and Why Do I Want One? Thursday, June the 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They'll meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, July the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium, located in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, July 5th at 7 p.m. The topic of presentation is The Secret History of Silicon Valley. They'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club will meet on Thursday, July the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. NYU Silver Building, room 405, located in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, July the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They'll meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane. They'll meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, July the 24th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, well, they have no meetings on July and August, but they'll resume meeting again in September. September the 7th, meeting time is 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Barter Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey, and we'll have more information on that at a later date. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meetings. At these club meetings, there is a random access period in which you can ask questions. And if you're a newbie user or going to a club first time or you have some technical questions, many of the members will be more than happy to help you. And just remember, there's no such thing as a dumb computer question. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup is very important for your data. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week. Stay safe and healthy and enjoy the summer.